Nerdy's Prime.
Hi, welcome to Nerdy's Prime, where we're reviewing Star Trek III for the 40th anniversary. It came out on June 1st, 1984, and it's now June 1st, 2024. It's the future. And let's start with our first impressions, but also, what were our impressions the first time we watched it, but what are our impressions this time when we watched it? Let's start with Namir, because he seems ready to me.
Well, let me get this straight. Wait, you want me to do past impressions and then present impressions?
Yeah, what's the first time you watched it? What did you think? And what do you think this?
Okay, this is interesting. The first time I watched it, I was like, what is this crap? I was not happy with it. I don't know why. I just didn't like it. It wasn't.
Well, wait, how old were you?
When did it come out?
84? It's the 40th anniversary.
Well, I can't. I don't know. I can't do math.
You just literally said that.
Do I pay attention to Wikipedia? No, I don't.
Star Trek, The Search for Spock. Spock is dead, and the crew of the Enterprise is bummed out, to say the least. Sarek crashes their celebration of life at Kirk's pad and starts talking all crazy about how Spock would have deposited his Katra, in essence his soul, into someone else's brain. Turns out McCoy got that honor and has become a little crazy himself, having Spock swimming around in his head now. Kirk asks the Badmiral to have the Enterprise back to see if Spock's body is still kicking around on the Genesis planet that they created in the last movie. Now the crew ditched their Starfleet uniforms for some, interesting civilian fashions and take up crime as they hijack their battle-damaged Enterprise from space dock. Sulu deals with some a-hole guards. Uhura deals with a nosy and naive lower decker, and then Kirk and friends escape pursuit of the fancy new USS Excelsior captained by Doogie Howser's dad. His ship is missing a few crucial components to make the ship go. They travel to Genesis, where Kirk's son David and Lieutenant Savick are marooned after the Klingons destroyed their science ship, the USS Grissom. The planet is currently aging rapidly, and so is a resurrected Spock. Unclear how baby Spock got out of his sealed photon tube casket. But anyways, the Klingon commander takes them prisoner and demands to be given the secrets of the Genesis Project. As usual, our heroes aren't talking, and David gets killed. Kirk and company go to the surface to rescue Spock and Savick as a Klingon boarding party tries to take control of the Enterprise. As they arrive on the bridge, the computer warmly greets them with severe burns and exposure to the vacuum of space as it completes a self-destruct sequence. Kirk engages in fisticuffs with the Klingon commander as Genesis falls apart around them. A couple of boot heels to the chops and the Klingon falls to his death. Kirk tricks the final Klingon manning the Bird of Prey into beaming them to safety, and they hijack their second ship in the movie. They make their way to Vulcan, and after a dull ceremony, Spock is kinda back. Hopefully, he'll also get his marbles back, because he's really gonna need them in the next movie.
I think it's 10. Yeah. So I saw it when I was 10, and it didn't connect with me. I didn't like it. I thought it was boring. I thought for whatever reason, I didn't like the change in Savick. You know, I don't know, something about her acting style, or there's something just different about her. I couldn't put my finger on it. But I didn't like that. I didn't like how it wasn't Kirstie Alley anymore. And that kind of threw me. And the scope of it seemed very small. And so it just didn't connect with me. I was like, I don't like this very much. But later on when I watched it, I was like, this is actually really good. I had a big gap between when I watched it the first time and then when I watched it the second time. And along that line, I matured as a human being. I started to appreciate the finer things in life. And then I realized that it's actually
like proper coverage.
Yeah, exactly. Proper coverage and acting. And so I realized that it was actually really good. I really enjoyed it. So that's where I am now. I watched it again yesterday, And I still really liked it. I was surprised. I thought, you know, this time around, it's going to be boring. I'm not going to like it that much, but it wasn't true. I liked it a lot. I think it's actually one of the better Star Trek movies, and it might be in my top three.
Alan. So I was racking my brain about this, but I have no specific memory of when I saw this movie for the first time.
I mean, it would have been probably the 90s sometime when I got into Star Trek. So,
but I've always liked it. I never really bought into the odd numbered Star Trek movies are terrible. You know, I like this movie. And I'm going to say that I really like this movie. And I consider probably what White Nemus says one of the better Star Trek movies. And it might be sacrilege to say, but I like Krug. Is it Krug? I don't think this. Do they say his name in the movie?
Krug. I think it's Krug. Commander Krug.
Yeah, they don't say like Klingon Commander, and I'm like, did they even mention his name in this movie? But anyway,
but I think I like him as a villain better than I even like Khan. I know that's probably sacrilege, but. I really enjoy Christopher Lloyd in this movie, and I think he's a great villain. But yeah, it's just, I watched it, just literally finished it probably 45 minutes before we started this, and yeah, I had a good time again.
So you're still basking in the rosy glow of Search for Spock.
Yeah, well, yeah, I just, there's not much I don't like about this movie. It's pretty solid.
Oh, already this review is going way differently than I thought it was going to go. Because I love this movie. I love this movie for sentimental reasons. I mean, I think it's a great movie, but Alan knows the story because I've said it many times, but this is the movie that got me into Star Trek. And I would have seen it on TV basically in like 89. And I remember Uncle Bob was hanging out the house and 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea was playing, and I wanted to watch that, and he wanted to watch Star Trek 3, and we were fighting over the remote, and we ended up watching Star Trek 3, and I also recorded it, because I was going to be like, well, we'll watch 20,000 Leagues, and then I'll record Star Trek 3, and you can watch it later. So I watched it, and I was like, oh my god, this movie's so good, and then I had to record as I watched it over and over again. This is what Star Trek is, this is amazing, and I just wanted to know everything about it afterwards. So, you know, I just watched it again today, and I go, it brings back all those memories. So loving Star Trek 3 and being completely confused because I didn't know what had happened. I didn't know who anybody was. I didn't know why it was the guy.
You didn't watch Star Trek 1 and 2 before you watched 3?
No, it was the first Star Trek game I had ever watched.
Oh, my God.
It's amazing how much you love something you didn't understand.
But I think what I liked about it, and one day I'd like to make a movie like this, but this idea of you kind of like come in the middle, like something happened, the ship is all like messed up and somebody died. And I thought that they were coming back from the TV show, that it was the TV show. And then, cause when they come back to Earth, it's like, you know, they've been gone for like actually a week in reality, but in the movie, they put the music in and whatever. And you think that's been like, it's been 5 years. There is Earth again. My word, Earth, you know? And then they just, you know, that's how they just kind of overplay it. And then, so in my impression as a young non-Star Trek viewer, I was like, they're coming back from their 5-year mission. Oh my God. And Spock died. What the hell? You know? So, yeah.
Oh. That is
okay.
That's too bad.
Well, let's talk about the Klingons because, This movie reintroduces the Klingons. So you see the Klingons for about 2 minutes in the first movie. You don't see them at all in the second movie. And they're the big bad guys from the original series. So we finally get the Klingons. And I don't know if you guys know this, but the reason that it's a bird of prey is originally the bad guys were supposed to be Romulans. And they decided halfway through, like, wait a minute, Romulans, we should really be doing the Klingons. So they kept they already had designed the ship and because it was based on the bird of prey from the Romans, but they just said, well, it's going to be a Klingon ship now. So what was let's start with Alan. Let's talk about the Klingons, the bird of prey, language, and Christopher Lloyd.
Again, I'm coming into this, you know, in the 90s or whatever, but an amazing casting choice to put Christopher Lloyd in that, because I guess, you know, at that point he was just a comedic actor. I mean, just Reverend Jim from Taxi. It's one of those things where it's like, oh, this seems like odd casting. Like, it seems like if this was like today and the internet, people would be like scoffing at that kind of casting. I'm like, really? Reverend Jim's going to be your villain? You're going to need to clean off. But he absolutely does such a good job in the role, and he basically set the standard, I guess, for how Klingons were portrayed from then on. And I think this was the Klingon that they spoke in this, the actual language that they developed. It wasn't just blah 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 blah. It was actually like from the dictionary.
Exactly. This is the stuff. Oh, that's. Hold on.
I think he's just going to the bathroom. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Dictionary
here.
Who are the authors on the dictionary? Does it say James Doohan?
No, it's Mark Ockrent. Remember?
It was like an actual linguist.
Jenny was talking about it for
the one we did. I thought James Doohan had something to like do with it. He kind of started it off. So he's not a co-author.
He came up with whatever they spoke in the first movie, in the motion picture.
It was meaningless. That's why the Klingons sound slightly Scottish.
So they got this guy to write the language. But what's fascinating is in all these movies, I think pretty much until Star Trek V, if you pay attention, they're actually speaking English. All the characters speaking in alien language are actually speaking English, and they're being dubbed over. So they had to pick Klingon words that would fit with the mouth.
What? I never really noticed, but I guess that's why.
What?
Yeah. They're saying their lines in English, and then they... series.
No, I'm talking about Star Trek 3. In Star Trek 3, if you watch it with the subtitles and put it on mute and look at the lips, they're actually saying what's in the subtitles.
Oh, that's really interesting.
And they just found a bunch of, words to just... But if you look back, that's what they do in Star Trek 2, and that's what they do in the first Star Trek movie.
Yeah. Oh, I guess... Why?
Well, I don't know, but I can only assume that maybe they hadn't developed the language yet, and... So they did it sort of retroactively, or I don't know.
So all these actors spent so many hours memorizing their lines, and then it just gets dubbed over with Klingon.
And it's only like once they got to Star Trek V, where they were like, "This is your the actor for Captain Claw got a script that was just like." So wait, it's you. I'm like, okay, I guess I'm learning this. These are my lines out. What is he? Yeah.
Getting back to the Klingons there, I also appreciate how ruthless, you know, that they are in this movie. Like, they're dangerous. Like, I mean, he takes no time in deciding that he's going to kill a hostage. And, you know, or his lady friend in the start of the movie, like, oh, you looked at these secret documents. I'm like, sorry, it's been fun, but, you know, you need to die now. So they felt dangerous. They felt threatening and menacing. And I love the Klingon portrayal in this movie.
Did you want to add anything to that, Namir?
No, I would just agree. Like, I Christopher Lloyd is... so good in that role.
He is so good, though he was not the first choice. He was the second choice.
He was the first choice.
Edward James Olmos.
Oh, God. I mean, I love Edward James Olmos. I love you some Adama, but yeah, like, this definitely was Christopher Lloyd's role. Yeah, as I read, he didn't fit the bill, even physically. Like, he was.
Well, because he's a little shorter, but Leonard Nimoy really loved him. He said he was amazing, and I would have loved to see a Captain Krug Adam.
Yeah, it's just, it would be like emergency power to the thrusters.
Yeah.
Right. So say we are.
So say we are.
But yeah, I think you know they need somebody tall and menacing to be a Klingon.
Yeah,
I can just feel like he doesn't have the stature to pull it off.
Yeah,
like every acting library, you know, they wouldn't have a problem with it.
Yeah, every time Christopher Lloyd says something, it's so memorable. I don't know what it is, just the way he delivers his lines, you know, what he's saying, how he's saying it. It's just like that. It just sticks in your brain. Like I find myself like years later just repeating some of those lines randomly. Just because of the way he said it, you know, like he just so good. Yeah, I can't say anything. Like he is, I think probably I would agree with that. Like he's up there with Khan. Like he's, but I do think he's better than Khan in terms of a villain.
He's pretty good.
Pretty well, good.
And he is very menacing.
Yeah, I feel like he's underrated.
Oh yeah.
And but also it's interesting because you could sort of say, well, the Klingons and the motion picture kind of, you know, put their footprint in the wet cement of what the Klingons were going to become. But it's really these Klingons, Christopher Lloyd and his buddies in this movie, that kind of set the stage for all the Klingons up until basically the J.J. Abrams reboot, or even until Discovery, yeah, when they themselves reboot the Klingons.
Christopher Lloyd and John Larroquette defined the Klingons for all of Star Trek.
Yeah. You have two comedic actors.
Yeah, exactly.
Our villains.
But I also really like how well they were defined. And you know, I'm not going to go on a sidetrack and bash some other TV show that has very ill-defined characters. But this one, it's like you have three characters and you're like, that's the boss. That's the second. That's the lieutenant. And that's the like, little science guy who's like, he wants to like fix things and make the world better, and you kind of get their dynamic right away, even though they don't have a lot of lines, and you understand what their relationships are, and it's just great. And this is like amazing, Ray. You know,
yeah. Especially since they don't get all that much screen time, like they get you know enough, but it's not like they're in it for very long.
Sir, will continue docking procedure.
Aye, sir.
There's this one thing where Chekhov speaks Russian, which I think is the only time he speaks Russian. And I wanted to bring it up because of that. And this time I was like, what does he say? And I thought that maybe the first part was Russian and the other second part was. And so I put the subtitles on and it's all Russian. And I still don't know what he says. And it was funny because for years I thought I just wasn't understanding. I thought he was talking English and I just with a Russian accent.
Did you look it up on the internet? What?
No, I didn't.
I mean, that's like my go-to, but
good story.
Yeah, good story. It's like an easy solve for this problem.
I was hoping you guys would know what he was saying.
My Russian is a little rusty.
Yeah, I just assumed it was like, look, it's a blinking light on the screen. Look.
I think I did look it up at some point, and it might be he's saying something like, ah, shit, I just changed that door, and now it's broken. Like, he's complaining, basically.
That would make sense. But, you know, yeah. I like that we don't know what he says, because it gives him a little bit of personality. Like, you know, like, I don't think he does. I mean, he speaks Russian in the show sometimes, but it's usually, like, when he's swearing or when something bad happens.
No, I think that's the only time. No. I think it's the only time.
I think he's spoken Russian.
I don't think he has.
No.
Really?
Never. No. I think this is the only time.
I can't really come up with any time he did.
Not even a net or a nosh boy or something like that. No?
I think no.
It seems odd.
Speaking of characters, it's, you know, there's everybody has something to do in this movie. And also, again, even though there's not that much screen time with each character, they all have a very clear personality. I mean, that was established in the original show, but again, like, it's not, you know, it's again really good writing of like, oh, this is what this character is like. this is what this character is like, you know.
I found in this one too, like they felt like a family. Like the other movies, you know, they're kind of, you know, too, in the motion picture, they're kind of just a crew. But in this one, it felt like they were really willing to go on a limb for each other and go on this quest to recover Spock. And, you know, it just seemed the scenes where they were together, like it seemed like they were more of a family than ever was depicted previously for this crew.
Well, and it's an interesting movie too, because this movie and Star Trek IV, they're in civilian clothes and they're kind of like off the, not off the grid, but do you know what I mean? They're
like undercover.
Yeah. Or something. They're not off the clock. They're not getting paid.
Off the clock.
Off the clock. That's what I'm trying to say. Yeah. And so it's kind of interesting because I think every other time you see them, they're always in uniform.
Mm.
And this is the only, these two movies are the only time where they're out of uniform kind of, but they're still the same, you know, have the same friendships and personality and character dynamics and so on and so forth. And it's also interesting what they wear, I find.
There's a lot of strange costumes in this. There's a lot of weird costumes in this movie.
Like, what is Chekhov wearing? He's wearing, like, some weird...
I don't know.
Pink suit or something? I don't know. But I love it. I love all the costumes.
It's probably like Kirk looks so ridiculous when he's, like, fighting with the crew at the end. And he's, like, it looks like a pirate blouse or something. He's got, like, puffy sleeves and... He's wearing a woman's blouse. He's fighting.
I think I like the fact that his street clothes looks a lot like his uniform. It's red and white.
Hey.
So it's like he still retains, like, I'm still the captain, even though I'm technically, you know, in streetwear. And then in Star Trek V, he has jeans and a plaid shirt.
Yeah, and doesn't Sulu have a cape?
He's going to climb a rock.
For some reason, Sulu has a cape.
Sulu has a cape, right?
I love everybody's costume. I love Dr. McCoy's costume. I don't understand what it is, but it's amazing. And he was wearing the same thing in the in Star Trek 2 as well.
I don't know.
Were you saying something else?
The security uniforms are very odd. Like the Enterprise security with the helmet.
Yeah.
And like they look like 1920s like football players.
Exactly.
Yeah. Do you guys remember we talked about this during the motion picture that he was wearing the same thing?
What? And then the space dock security guys when they got like the ball cap with like that little those little maze games that you get like as a toy at Swiss Chalet. It's like the little bead maze. I'm like, why are these putting the bead maze and just stuck it on a baseball cap and now they're you know.
I love those uniforms. I want to go as one of those guys for Halloween. That would be like the highest I could aspire to in my life. Let's talk about the new designs of the ships. There's Space Dog, Excelsior, Grissom, and the cargo ship. Namir, what are your thoughts of these new designs?
Let's see. The Grissom. No thoughts on the Grissom. It's fine. It's interesting. Whatever. But the Excelsior was kind of cool. I kind of like the Excelsior. It has like a weird, like it's supposed to look much more modern than the Enterprise, and they somehow pull it off, right? It's got that weird, like, strange ribbed neck, and then it's got like a weird, you know, I don't know, nacelle portion. It looks like it's hefty, you know, and it looks futuristic. But you're already in the future, so it's like, wow, that's pretty amazing that they were able to pull that off, right? Like, so I kind of liked it. And then what was the other thing? The space station?
The cargo ship.
Oh, at the beginning?
Yeah.
I don't know. It looks. Is there something about it? It looks like a cargo ship.
Well, they designed it for this movie, but then it kept coming back in the Next Generation and probably the other shows as well. I remember it was the bad guy. No, it wasn't. What was it in? I was about to say it was in The Survivors, but that wasn't the one in The Survivors.
Oh, it's been reused in several films.
Yeah, anyways.
Oh, I like that. I like that they reuse ships like that. It makes sense, right? Like it's probably like a model of a ship that, you know, people who ship cargo purchase. You know, they just happen to all look like that for whatever reason.
Well, there's also the design of the Bird of Prey. I realize that we didn't really talk about that, but that's like an amazing design.
Oh yeah, I think that's the thing. That's like what, this was sort of the, the designs are so good that it strikes that balance where they don't call attention to themselves. You know, like you're not like, they feel natural. Like they feel like they're used. They feel real. They feel like they're actual ships. And you're not like, oh, look at the design of that. Of that starship, right? You just accept that that's the way it's supposed to look, right? Which I think is really, really hard to do, right? So the Bird of Prey looks exactly the way it should. The Grissom looks exactly the way that it should. That cargo ship does. You know, the Excelsior, it all kind of makes sense. Like they're good enough where you can go, I like that design, but then you don't dwell on it, right? Because it feels like it belongs in this galaxy, which is really hard. So kudos to them. That's a real trick.
But when they did Bill George at ILM designed the Excelsior, and I think his idea was it's going to be like an anime or a Japanese version of the Enterprise. Indeed. So he made it all like, and yeah, the designs are so good that they just continued being used for years and years and years.
Yeah.
And then, and Sulu becomes, captain of the Excelsior eventually. And so the Excelsior itself just stays in the movies pretty much until the end. So
what I really want to know is what transwarp is.
Oh yeah. I wish they would have kept with that.
Makes it go faster.
Makes it go fast. Well, I think they brought transwarp back with the Borg and Voyager, didn't they, Alton?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think by coming Next Generation, maybe Descent. And he's talked about transwarp conduits and things like that for the Borg. But they never really explained it other than that, it's like it's faster than warp. whatever that is.
Yeah, that's kind of too bad because it was like, in other episodes, including, in the Discovery series, they come up with these new ways of traveling. But I'm like, but they never kind of took transwarp and really fleshed it out, and that could have been the new thing, in future series or future episodes. But
well, anyways. Maybe transwarp is a spore drive. We don't know.
Well, my assumption was that Scotty embarrassed Captain Asshole so much that then they just said, "Well, let's just scrap the transwarp program." Or maybe Scotty broke it forever. He just broke it, and then they couldn't fix it.
Yeah. Those four little battery type things that he had just destroyed the entire technology.
He's like, do some things.
Yeah. We can never make in more of them.
But I think that's one of the things I like to get back to, like the studio model where I think that's one of the things I like about this movie is that it's gorgeous. And like, I find myself just enthralled. I love that there's so many new models introduced, and it's like everything is through so many beauty shots, and they don't overdo it like the motion picture did, but it's still so much like the scope of Space Dock and the Excelsior. I was never a fan of the old Birth class, like the Grissom there. I always thought that ship kind of looked stupid, but I appreciate the fact that we got a nice new model. But yeah, it's just this movie is so much gorgeous, motion control work. And I just love it. Like, I don't even get distracted with my phone or anything. I'm just always watching like, oh my God, this is so beautiful.
I know. I was watching it. I watched half of it today and half of it yesterday. And last night I was going, oh my God, this is so good. Like, we're about to get to the stealing of the Enterprise, but that whole sequence is amazing. But, I've seen this movie so many times. It's rare that I see something new. But this time, when they were getting into Space Dock, I noticed off in the corner, where it was the shot of the Excelsior, in the corner there was another ship there that I'd never seen before that looks like, I want to say that Ted Adam, who did Doctor Strange, the production designer, Doctor Strangelove, and he had done some, he was famous for doing the James Bond movies. He had been hired early development when they were going to do a movie called Star Trek and the Planet of the Titans, I think. And he had redesigned the Enterprise. The USS Discovery is based on that design that Ken Adam did in the 70s. But all this to say that this ship that I think you see the little tale of in the space dock, I think it's that ship.
So, yeah. It'd be Discovery.
If you know, put it the in the comments.
I don't. I guess it couldn't be Discovery because they'd already been a feature by then.
Well, no, but I'm just saying Discovery was based on that original model. So, yeah, it's not Discovery. Don't know what Discovery doesn't. Anyway. Okay, so I want to just talk briefly about the Genesis planet because I was kind of gonna go over it because it's more something from Star Trek 2, but it's such a big part of this movie as well. So, Alan, what are your thoughts about Genesis Planet and how it's used as a plot device in this movie?
Well, I would say that Genesis Planet is even more important in this movie than it was in Star Trek 2. I love the fact that it's just a weird science. Like, again, I'm a huge fan of high concept science fiction stuff. So, I love that there's this planet with all these different temperature zones within walking distance or whatever they say. It was just a cool idea. And the fact that it's like, it's basically growing, destroying itself. I just love that set too on the planet. Like it seems so ambitious for the time, like how everything's moving, like trees are flying out of the ground and rocks are falling. Like that's a great set. And I love this. Yeah, it brought a sense of chaos around all the other character drama that's happening. And it's like, it's such a dynamic environment. And it just made everything more exciting, I thought, in the latter half of the movie.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's just such a weird planet. It's just fun to watch. Everything's windy. There's weird creatures everywhere. There's snow on top of cactuses. You're like, what the hell is happening on this planet? I mean, something's wrong, which is great.
Well, and I think what's interesting, what's happening is, David Marcus talks about that he used protomatter in the Genesis Matrix, whatever that means, and that's basically the basis of the problems because it's unpredictable. And it seems like to me what it does is it created a planet in the same way that, say, Earth was created. Instead of being created over billions of years, it was created like in a day or whatever. But then the acceleration didn't stop. It just kept on going. Mm-hmm. So it went through the whole life cycle of the entire planet tectonically or whatever. The geology of the planet just aged like 4 or 5 billion years in like a week. And that's what happened at the end of the movie. It just like kind of falls apart. But it's what allows the regeneration of Spock, and then at the end of the movie, suddenly it's Leonard Nimoy.
I know it's such a great plot device to bring back Spock.
It's funny to me. It always felt like they put him in a microwave, and then at the end of the movie, he goes ding, and they take him out, and he's ready.
Hello, like popcorn.
It's Leonard Nimoy.
Leonard Nimoy is too hot. It's amazing that they got him exactly at the same point where he died.
Just
right timing.
It's 350 degrees for 45 minutes exactly. Not they didn't overdo him.
Yeah, get teenage Spock. Oh, they didn't get like old man Spock. They got their Spock. Yeah. Right?
If I was Spock, I would have been like, really? You couldn't have stopped this like 20 years ago when I was a little bit younger. A little bit more spry,
a little more virile.
Okay, let's get to the for me is like the best part of the movie, which is I think what like I think when this happened when I saw it as a 13-year-old is like the stealing of the Enterprise, the prison break, and the stealing of the Enterprise. That's when I was like, okay, I'm watching this movie now, because. Oh, it's just, I can't say enough good things. And the music is the score by James Horner, who came back after Star Trek 2. It's so good.
Yeah, I love that sequence. I think it's amazing. It's so much fun to watch. Everything clicks, like the cast is on. you know, they all, everybody has a role. Their comedic timing is just like perfect, you know, like it's just so great. I love the joke where they're just about to hit the space doors. I love that they call them space doors. I just find it really funny. The space doors. And Kirk's like, now, Mr. Scott. And Scott is like, I am working on it.
Yeah, and then Kirk only realizes that. He's like, oh, shit, I thought he had it all figured out. He's like, no, I'm still hacking. I'm still trying to...
Now, Mr. Scott. The doors, Mr. Scott. Thanks, I'm working on it.
That's so good. And actually, you know, that whole sequence makes me think that, like, that's the first time I feel like this movie, like a Marvel movie style movie, existed. Like, you know, like a really great blend of, you know, and I think maybe Indiana Jones is like that as well, but like a really great blend of action and comedy and real serious moments and, you know, drama, like all genres kind of mixed together. Search for Spock and Wrath of Khan really feel like that to me. So I wouldn't be surprised if like Kevin Feige was like, okay, the Marvel movies are going to be like the early Star Trek movies. We're just going to follow that pattern. We'll follow that blueprint because they feel very similar to me.
Yeah, and I just love how the heist, they see, like in more recent Star Trek, they've been trying to do heists. And they're basically just imitating Mission Impossible heists. And this is like basically a heist, but they, you know, it's like its own thing. It's still in the Star Trek world. And I just love how with the music, it's like here and now we're here. And now we're talking with this person. And you're seeing all these perspectives and it's all coming together. I love when they go to Doogie Howser's dad and he's like, what? Who's stealing Enterprise? That's impossible. And he's got this little, and he's like so smug and he's got the, I know, he got this little stick like he's a jockey.
Yeah.
And he's like, puts on his arm.
I also called him Doogie Howser's dad. That's what I recognize him from when I watched this. just interrupt.
Yeah. What's the name of the actor? James Skidding? No, Skidding?
Oh, hell, something. I don't even know. I just know Doogie Howser's dad.
But he was in Outland. That's the other movie I remember. Yeah. So he was no stranger to science fiction. He had done Outland before, but he's great in this movie. And then I remember the way they presented the Excelsior, like in the bridge is like a shopping center. It's like huge. and they do that Good Morning Captain gag when it all falls apart. It's great. I mean, I think it's really the music that sells that sequence because it's building and building and building.
Kirk. If you do this, you'll never sit in the captain's chair again.
Warp speed.
Aye, sir.
Warp speed.
And then it leaves. What's funny?
I just thought of another funny part. Okay, yep. So in this shouldn't work, but for some reason it does. It's that shot of the Excelsior in space about to hit transwarp. And then it cuts out, and there's like a sputtering engine noise. It's like,
I know
it sounds like a car breaking down on the highway.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like it sounds like it ran out of gas. You know, I mean, you're like, that shouldn't work, but it does. It works just so perfectly.
It's like there's no sound in space. I'm like, why am I hearing this thing sputter to a stop?
It's a gas engine, so carburetor.
You know, there's the exhaust. And I like how annoyed Mrs. Scott is with the Excelsior and all the new stuff. And he takes the elevator and he says, level, please. He says, transporter room. Thank you. And he's like, up your shaft.
So mean.
Yeah.
But by the way, the voice of the turbo lift is Leonard Nimoy.
Oh, interesting. Interesting that the Excelsior had a different computer voice, right? Like, why would it have a different computer voice than Majel Barrett?
Oh, because Majel Barrett didn't do this by doing computer voice until Next Generation, which was a few years later.
Or whatever the computer voice was.
No, you're right. She did the computer voice in the original series, too. So I'm wrong and you're right.
Really? That's surprising.
But I don't know who did the computer voices in the movies. Do you guys know? I can't even think of if there was a computer voice other than this Leonard Nimoy bird.
I don't know, but it was weird that they use a different voice just to, I guess, accentuate how different the Excelsior was, like how modern it was supposed to be. So they changed everything up.
Like your father, you changed the rules.
If I hadn't, it might have been years or never.
How many have paid the price for your impatience? How many have died? How much damage have you done? And what is yet to come?
Okay, do you guys think that David and Savick have a romance? Because I read the novelization, and in the novelization, they become a couple. And there's, I don't know how much time passes between Star Trek 2 and 3, but I imagine there's not that much time, because it feels like all the things that happened in Star Trek 2, it's just nothing much has happened. They're still on their way back from Star Trek 2 at the beginning of Star Trek 3. So how long has it been? But somehow Savick and David have gone back to Earth, gone on the USS Grissom, and gone back to the planet. So I guess somewhere in there they could have had a romance, but did you guys ever feel like there was something romantic between them?
Yeah, I did. I thought it was pretty heavily implied that they were a couple, or at least that there was something going on. I don't know. I mean, I didn't really think about that because I just assumed they were.
Yeah.
I don't know. There was nothing in there otherwise.
Good friends / colleagues, or they're dating.
Yeah,
there's something there.
But more to the point, did Savick and teenage Spock have sex?
Yes.
Because when I watched it as a kid, I was like, oh, they're just rubbing fingers. And then later I watched it and I was like, oh, that's totally like foreplay. And the thing is, you can interpret it any way you want. But what makes me think that it can't, that they actually had sex and that she helped little young Spock through his Pungfar. Well, first of all, that's the only way to resolve a Pungfar. But
exactly.
But the other thing is, if you watch the very end of the movie when Spock looks at her, she looks down like embarrassed, like, oh, I remember we did the thing.
And Spock's like, remember that?
You and I.
No, because wasn't that one of the plans too? Was she was supposed to be pregnant with Spock's child in Star Trek 4? I thought that was like
abandoned or dropped plot line.
Yeah, I'm glad they didn't.
I think that was kind of a plan.
But actually, but yeah,
they totally did it. 100%.
Right. The mirror, you don't have an opinion about this, or you just
I knew there was some weird release thing happening with the Pungfar. I didn't assume that they had sex. Like, they didn't even really imply
what sex.
I don't see how that could be. How could that be?
I thought they said all their power, you know, from mind melds and neck and all that stuff come through their fingers. So when they touch fingers like that, that's how they have their sexual release.
Well, maybe, but that's different than like biological.
I
thought
I was actually watching a sex scene here when I'm watching them. I'm like, oh, this is kind of weird. I'm like,
I think it's, but like, I think that's different
than an older woman.
I think that's different than biological sex to reproduce, right? Like whatever they did was a different version of that, which is, you know, uniquely Vulcan.
And so yeah, I thought that's how they shared their energies and their feeling.
Sure.
I always thought that it was just that was like Vulcans were just not very affectionate. So their version of a hug or holding hands was just like to touch fingertips.
Right. So
which is from the original series as well. There's so much stuff from the original series that I didn't appreciate at the time. But when I went back to watch the original series, like, first of all, Mark Leonard is in this movie, and that's the first time he plays Sarek since 1967. And that's amazing. And then the whole finger thing is him and his wife and A Journey to Babel in 67 as well. So, you know, it's great that they really keep things internally consistent.
So I think Spock and I think they were intimate, but they didn't necessarily, you know, like bump kind of thing.
I'm beeping that out. Now.
If you do not surrender immediately, I will execute them one at a time as enemies of galactic peace.
Who is this? How dare you take prisoners?
Who I am is not important. That I have them is.
Okay, so we get to the Genesis planet. Krug is there. Death of David. How do we feel about Death of David, Alan?
The and this is where I feel like Krug is like the better villain over Khan, because I'm like, then he made it personal because he killed Kirk's son, and I was like, that just, you know, because when you look at Khan really didn't do anything to Kirk. Kirk more did stuff to Khan, like abandoned him on this planet and let him fester and get angry and resentful. But, you know, this one, they made it personal. And I just felt that made a, you know, the villain protagonist relationship into up the stakes. And it was, I was actually, I mean, now I'm not so surprised, I know it off by heart, but, you know, when I first saw it, I was actually quite surprised that, you know, they off David that abruptly. You know, he says, "Oh, kill somebody," and then he takes a dive. I'm like, "Oh, wow!" Well, then it gets us into him. And I mean, I guess, you know, in Star Trek, nobody's necessarily dead. Maybe the Genesis planet could have revived him. Somebody just wrote it that way, but in this case, he's dead, and it made that fight between a final fight between the two of them. So much more emotional because he had just murdered his son. Or basically ordered, I guess he didn't murder him, but he, you know, he ordered his murder, and then I guess he died in a scuffle, but, you know, yeah. And just that whole time when Kirk, like, falls back and misses his chair, like, oh, I was like, I love that scene with Shatner. This is a good job.
Sorry. You can see the craft, yeah. Like, people can make fun of William Shatner for his, you know, overacting and this and that, and he sometimes does overact, but he has such craft, you know. He's like, well, he studied Shakespeare and he came up through theater, and you can tell that he's like really thinking of all the little moments, and he doesn't, and he puts his 100% into it, and he can't, I never feel like he can fault somebody for you know, putting the 100% into it, and I just really feel it in that scene, and I love how
his reaction is so memorable. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that whole, you know, Klingon bastards, you killed my son. It just stays with them, and it comes back in Star Trek VI, and that's just like a beautiful little continuity between the movies, and really feeds into like what is going to become his prejudice against Klingons, you know, all those years later. Because, you know, they kind of try to make like the Klingons like his arch nemesis, but before Krug, nobody had ever done anything. Like, Kor hadn't really done anything. He was just annoying, and Koloth was annoying, but nobody had actually done anything personal to him. Yeah. And this was the first time that it's like, now I hate Klingons. Yeah.
Computer, destruct sequence 1, code 1, 1A.
So, destruction of the Enterprise. It's the second, my second favorite scene in the whole movie, and didn't see that coming either. Of course, this was the first Star Trek movie I saw, so there was no like build up to like, what? Destruction of the Enterprise. I barely even knew what the Enterprise was at that point. But what I love about that sequence is that the whole ritual, the destruct code ritual, where they go 1A, 2B, and all that stuff, it's copied directly from Let That Be Your Last Battlefield. Is that the name of the episode?
Battle.
This, Alan, you must confirm everything for me. Tell me I'm right.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. They're going to destroy the Enterprise, except it's like, I think it's Kirk, Spock, and Scotty in that episode. And this one, it's with Chekhov instead.
Is it the same codes?
It's exactly the same.
Still 000, yeah. Destruct 0.
Yeah. Which I think is amazing.
But you could say that by accident.
So Namir, what did you think of the destruction sequence?
Yeah, I like it. I thought it was really great. I, you know, I always have a laugh because those codes are so easy. They're like 1, 1, A, 1, A,
And then Chekhov is like, one, two, three. Three, two, one. You know, it's like, you know, my grandmother's TIN number kind of thing. You know? But it's a lot of fun. I like it. I think it's great. That whole sequence is fantastic. You know, even when the Klingons come over and then they radio back to...
Something's talking.
Yeah, something's talking. And he's like, get out! Get out of there! You know, it's so amazing. Pretty good. I love it. That's such a great sequence.
Yeah, and they did such a great job on the model, how they blew up the model, and they showed, like, the, you know, the inside of the Enterprise, like the skin burning, and you see the inside, and you know, it's like all these moments. Though,
you know, the self-destruct for a spaceship to keep it out of enemy hands only destroyed like the front of the saucer section, and then the rest, it just happened to burn up in the atmosphere. I'm like, I feel like the warp nacelles and warp cores would blow up, and then the whole ship would just go. Like, why would it just one part of it?
I read in a book that a starship has two self-destruct modes. There's one where you do the matter antimatter and it blows up the whole ship. But there's another way you do it where everything overheats at the same time. Like all the computers and the wiring and everything overheats. And it's like more like it's the slow melting. And that's to destroy all like the information on board. And so that's the option they had picked. That explains that.
Oh, so yeah, it looks like there'd be if there didn't happen to be a planet to fall into and burn up in the atmosphere, it looks like there would have been a ton of ship that they could have just salvaged and took Federation secrets from. Well, no, but I guess that's what Lucas is saying, that version of the self-destruct destroys all that stuff. Like it melts all the hard drives and the memory and all of that.
So it's a slower burn.
It's a canon thing, though. Yeah, maybe.
I read that in the book.
Yeah. Visually, watching this movie, it looks like a faulty self-destruct. Yeah. Well, because you're like, right, because we only blew up a small part of the ship. Because when you watch it, you're like, oh, it should be okay. Well, they could still fly this thing out of there.
Rebuild the front.
Yeah, they just like plaster that over. It should be fine. Put a new bridge on top.
And then all that blows up.
Some duct tape.
Yeah.
Wrap that in duct tape and it'll be fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it must have. Yeah, no, wait a second. I got my Enterprises mixed up. Never mind. Because nobody salvages this Enterprise. It never comes back.
No. Nope.
Yeah, okay.
No, they just get a new Enterprise and they call it the A.
Yeah.
Which was cool in this film series, but this is less cool. You know, 50 years later in Star Trek Picard, but anyway.
My God, Bones. What have I done? What you had to do. What you always do. Turn death into a fighting chance to live.
Okay, so we get down to the planet. It's like we get to the big climax where we actually get a mano a mano between Kirk and Krug, and I think this is the only like Kirk fisticuffs you get in the whole film series, other than that little fight with the at the prison in Star Trek 6, mm-hmm. Right? But it's great because I mean, we get like a classic Kirk, like, you know,
yeah, he does the
hand karate chops,
he does the double fist.
Yeah. Alan, what are your thoughts about the climax?
Again, I love that scene because, like I said earlier, I love that set. I love all the chaos and the things blowing up around them while they're fighting. It has this, you know, epic feel to it. I don't know how to like put my finger in it, and I love that, and the fact that, you know, and then we have the usual when the bad guy's hanging on the precipice, and he's like, oh, I'll save you, and then he still, you know, insists on being a villain, and he just kicks him in the face. I love that. That's one of my favorite like ending lines, you know, for when they kill a bad guy and they get the one liner. It's like, that's just like, no, you in the face.
Except I never understood what he said. To me, it always sounds like he goes, I have had it. enough with you. And I go, well, like, what? That doesn't make grammatically any sense.
I have had enough of you.
Like, I'm just tired of your bullshit. It's like you boots in the face. Yeah.
Never understand.
It's such a great in scenes like that where the bad guy's hanging off the edge and then the good guy's, you know, he's always like, give me your hand. You're like, no, you won. Just kick him off. You know, just, you know. Well, I just try to show that they're virtuous.
Sometimes it doesn't make sense. But I think in this case, in Star Trek world, it makes sense because that's Kirk's duty. His duty is to be respect human, you know, life and sentient life and all this sort of stuff.
I know, but just a second before that, he was like, I'm going to murder you. You know, like, well, but it's Starfleet ideals kicked in. You're like, oh, I need to.
I am not judge, jury, and executioner. I need you'll face justice if I can, you know, arrest you.
Yeah, and it was just the guy, like, was just too much of a pain in the ass. I was like, you know what? Just so this one time, I'm just going to kick this guy off.
Yeah.
Off it's the,
like
the
cliff face. No one's
into
here to witness
it. It's a molten lava.
You, help us or die.
I do not deserve to live.
Fine, I'll kill you later.
Okay, and now at the end, it's just Jean-Luc Roquette is the only one who's left at the end.
Yeah, you know, my question is always, what do they do with the guy? Because he doesn't show up in the Voyage Home. Do they talk about him ever again?
Well, I think they get him to the Vulcans. The Vulcans like rehabilitating him or something.
But they never show that. You don't know. I always just assumed he was still in the brick.
I think he's
meditating.
No, this is what I think. I think that it's actually the best thing that could ever happen to that guy is he gets stuck on Vulcan because that's really he was the reason one. He was the logical, reasonable, rational guy, the only one on the ship, and he was misunderstood by his fellow Klingons, but. Really, he went off to live his fullest life on Vulcan after this.
Mm. I like that story. I've always liked Maltz.
Yeah, me too.
The first Klingon of the Vulcan Science Academy. And all he does is say,
okay.
5,000 kalagams. 10,000 kalagams.
Okay, so the ending is the Khatra ritual. So how do we feel about the Khatra ritual? To me, it's always like the movie's done when the Genesis plan blows up, and then I just want an ending. And then there's like another 15 minutes of like, magic, and it's less exciting.
Definitely has like a Return of the King kind of ending where it just doesn't end.
But it's nothing like the everlasting ending of. Star Trek Discovery that we're going to talk about in a minute. What do you think of the Khatra ritual?
I think they have to do it, right? Like they had to have this type of resolution for Spock, right? So they had to happen because, you know, Bones' storyline needed to end, you know, the whole Spock thing needed to get wrapped up. So I thought that was an interesting way of doing it. I don't know if the Khatra ritual was in any of the other episodes. Like, I mean, I feel like this whole dying but preserving your, I guess, psychic essence thing is new to Search for Spock. Like that's how they explain that he lives. So all of this is new. But it was fine. I thought it was well done. You needed that ending part. And I like the scene where Spock starts recognizing everybody and remembering who people are, and he says that great, I will always be your, shall ever be your friend kind of line. So it was a nice ending. I think you needed it.
Yeah, it does kind of take the steam out of things. Like you say, we had a great climax and then we had this quiet, long resolution. I do feel like that ending ran a little long. That's when I start checking my phone. Because I feel like, Vulcan mysticism and stuff is kind of boring. But then, then we get the nice little character moment at the very, very end where it's like, Jim, your name is Jim. And but that's such a nice little theme. And, you know, I wish they couldn't sped up the whole ceremony and just got to that part. And there's that weird shot, too. I like when everyone come over when they realize that he was back, you know, coming back to himself, you know, recognizing them, and then everybody rushes over it to say, "Oh, fuck!" But yeah, it's a nice moment at the end.
Yeah, well, you know, and it's also like a return to the original depiction of Vulcan, because, you know, you had portrayed Vulcan as a red planet and a mock time on the original show. And then when, I mean, they fixed it afterwards, but the version of Vulcan they had in the motion picture was like kind of different. It had like a no atmosphere and a black sky, and it was kind of weird. But this one kind of returned to what it was supposed to be. But then they did this gorgeous, they made this gorgeous matte painting at ILM for the whatever Mount Celea, and it just, it's really nice. Yeah, all those Vulcans, it was pretty cool. It's nice to have like a big motion picture, you know, version of Vulcan. And I didn't know who she was at the time, but later realized that the, I don't forget the name of the high priestess to something. Pelt?
To something.
She's played by Dame Judith Anderson, who was sort of a big star. I think maybe she won an Oscar, but she was a big star in the 40s and 50s. And she played the evil housekeeper in Rebecca, which comes back in kind of a Janeway's holodeck program.
Yeah.
She's that kind of character comes back. And then she also was kind of the evil housekeeper or whatever in the Ten Commandments, the one who, I don't know, something that happens to Moses and it was all her fault.
Oh yeah, she betrays Moses and Moses' mother by keeping Moses' blanket to prove that he's
right, exactly. A Jew. Yeah, yeah.
So that he's Jewish, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep.
So yep, there we go. Okay, let's. And I like that. This is the only other movie that has a little subtitle at the end, and the adventure continues.
Yeah.
It has I think in the motion picture, it's the human adventure is just beginning, and in this movie, it's like, and the adventure continues. But that's it. That's the only other time. But I like that you have a little dot 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 as like continuing the sentence from such a motion picture.
Yeah, which is great because it picked that up. It continues. Like with no break to the Voyage Home, there's like it just goes. It's part you know, four, I guess, or part three, in the, you know, that sequence.
Well, this is kind of like the Empire Strikes Back of the trilogy, in some ways.
Yeah, in that it's in the middle.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Because no other comparison. It's not the same in any other way.
There's a cape and Empire Strikes Back, and there's a cape in this movie too. Just saying. Yeah,
that's true. And there's guards with little baseball hats.
Okay, let's go to our final thoughts and our ratings. Let's start with Alan.
Again, I can't really fault this movie on much. I don't know why, you know, originally that. People felt like it was a weak link in the trilogy for Wrath of Khan, Search for Spock, Voyage Home. Because I think this movie is good from start to finish. And I say I find it visually compelling. The characters are all spot on. We have, you know, a great villain. It's a really great movie. And it's probably, you know, one of my favorite Star Trek movies. And one of the better written ones, I think, too. Are we doing it out of 10? I don't. We didn't really talk about it. But yeah. Okay.
So yeah, I probably give this one pretty high marks. I would give it an 8 out of 10.
I don't think I've watched it many times, and it never gets old for me.
Excellent, Namir.
Yeah, I agree with Alan. I've watched it a bunch of times. And it's always good. I'm never like, this seems to get worse over time. It kind of almost gets better over time. So I'm going to give it a 9.
Well, yeah, I really like this movie. I would say that I have two little nitpicks, and one is Uhura's kind of written out of the movie halfway through. And I wish I would have seen more of her. I mean, her role is kind of pivotal because she's the one like goes behind the scenes and contacts Sarek and says all that up, but we don't get to see any of that stuff. And that would have been kind of interesting to see her little like side spy trip. to Logan.
She's the guy in the van.
She's the guy in the van, yeah. Yeah, because I think if I'm not mistaken, I think in the novelization, we actually follow her. To all the way to Logan. And then the one other nitpick is there's a scene with Dr. McCoy where he goes to the bar and he's trying to get like a ship with the weird guy. And I like the scene, but I never understood how it functioned in the plot. Like they're already, you know, trying to steal the Enterprise. So why is he looking for a ship? Like, and it's just, I don't know. I got confused about that.
Well, I don't think he knows that they were trying to steal the Enterprise. Right, like they.
So you think that he's being possessed by Spock? Yeah. And he's just trying to find a way to.
Yeah, yeah. Like they needed a reason for everyone else to break him out.
Yeah,
right. So he's on his own kind of side quest. Gets thrown in the loony bin, and then that sort of starts everything up.
Hello, I see. That makes sense.
How many times did you watch this movie?
So many times, but I 8 out of 10. I give it 8 out of 10. I think it reminds me of. The reason I got into Star Trek, so I love it for that reason alone. Even if it was a horrible movie, I'd still love it, but it's a great movie, and we can all agree. Okay, so we'll be back next week. So there's going to be a review of Star Trek The Motion Picture, Part 2. We're going to go back to reviewing Star Trek The Next Generation, and there's also a review of Discovery. Been dropped yesterday, so you don't have to check that out, but yeah.
They do.
What are you talking about?
What are you talking about?
That's the opposite of what you're want supposed people to say. Watch.
Nerdiest Prime is Namir Med, Lucas Cardona Morissette, Ellen O'Neill, and Jenny R. Johnson. Check out our YouTube channel and leave a review.